Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live but not in studio in New York City. I'm on the road. Today, we're going to take a look at the leaked real U.S. goals for Syria. And shouldn't this put us on notice when we find the truth of why we actually did all this devastation and created this conflict in Syria? That those who were responsible be held accountable? Something we'll discuss. Also, if time permits, we're going to look at the cult of Silicon Valley in an audio clip. My guest in the second part of our program from the United Kingdom is an award-winning British journalist writing on human rights, Dr. Tim Coles, and we're going to talk about how fake news is used as techniques for propaganda as a form of population and mind control. And it's going back a long time, as you will hear. This is a subject of fake news you have not heard in the past. Also today, the latest on health and healing, and that's where we're going to begin. So we have a full show. This is from the Carnegie Mellon University. And it's about, as temperatures rise, Lyme disease will get worse. Rising temperatures may boost the number of cases of Lyme's disease, already the most common tick-borne disease in North America, by more than 20%. Now, Lyme's disease is a serious condition, and it's on the increase. And since its progression depends upon environmental factors, increases in daily temperature, a manifestation of climate change, might be contributing to the rise in the number of ticks, as well as a greater availability of host. Quote, a sizable increase in the incidence of cases of Lyme disease in the United States due to climate change is imminent, so says a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie's Mellon University. So, a couple things that we can do. This was published in the Canadian Journal of Infectious Disease and Medical Microbiology. First, anytime you're outside gardening, playing, running with your dogs or cats, understand that you're in an environment now that no longer can you assume it'll just be a wonderful and bucolic and relaxing moment. You could be bringing right back into the house with you ticks, as many people do, or their dogs. So if you have a dog, then have a flea brush or flea comb. It's small enough that when you take it through their hair, including behind their ears and around their paws and their tail, you'll see the ticks. That way you can just squash them, kill them. Same way with fleas. Also, you should wear socks, preferably white socks, and just put your pants in the socks. Why? Because if a tick is going to get up your leg, it's going to have to climb across your shoes and onto your pants. If your pants are dragging down into the ground, it's easy for the tick to get on and you wouldn't know it. It could go in the inside, and that frequently happens. But if you simply take about three or four Q-tips, dip them in tea tree oil, and wipe around the outer sole and heel of your shoe, you're protecting yourself because ticks have an aversion to tea tree oil. It's very toxic to them. So that's, and then when the sock is seen, and you'll see if you have a tick on it when you come back in. Just a couple things. And then if you have a lawn, and I don't care how large a lawn is, it could be 20 acres. Simply on dry days, not wet, take diatomaceous earth, which is used in filtration of swimming pools, and load it in, and then use a spreader so it can spread it out. And just walk it around your property so all of it looks like it has a fine white coat, a powder on it. That's going to go down into the root and be on the ground. It's going to kill spiders, ticks, and any other insect because it lacerates. Because that diatomaceous earth is actually, it's a fossilized material. And when the tick or spider or insect comes across it, like an ant, fire ant, it lacerates them and they dehydrate. I've been living on farms and ranches my entire adult life and do so now for over 20, almost 25 years. And before that, down in Texas for 7 years. And then upstate New York for 15 years. And Lake Pacong, New Jersey for 6 years. And I never had a tick bite, nor any other problems, because I always make sure I use diatomaceous earth. So when you're using diatomaceous earth, you're doing a great deal of good. Now, when you have a larger property, and I had a 200-acre ranch that thousands of you visited over the years down in Texas, the Healing Springs Ranch, you would see these guinea hens and chickens running everywhere. Well, I'd give the eggs to the neighbors as a gift because they were so kind. Every morning, there'd be some bushel basket or something of a fruit or vegetable, stream beans, peaches, apples, just sitting at the door, not even a name on it. It's the way people who care about being good neighbors do things. And so I would take the eggs from the chickens. One time I had 500 chickens. And I would take the eggs, and I would give the eggs to one of the gardeners, and they could sell them at the farmer's market because they were fertile eggs, organic, from free-range chickens. And then I would also give some to the neighbors. Well, I never had a tick or spider problem at all because they'll go after everything. Scorpions, guinea hens are the best of the best. First of all, they're crazy. To watch them, you can't help but laugh. They just, for no reason, they just suddenly all run in one direction. And they keep together as a group. Makes them more difficult for predators like hawks and eagles to pick them off. And they'll eat everything. I've seen them eat copperheads, water moccasins, tarantulas, and scorpions. And of course, most lethal is the brown reclusive spider and black widows. As a result, in all the years, decades that I've lived on in the country, never poison ivy, poison oak, poison sumac, nothing. Simple precaution. And also chickens are wonderful too, especially rescued, because they're very friendly. They love being loved. And kids can really appreciate what it is to bond with a sentient being because they'll sit there and let you pet them, but they eat insects. Better to do that than to have something like a pesticide that's toxic. Anyhow, they get rid of ticks. The Council for Responsible Nutrition issued a statement regarding the vitamin D and omega-3 trials that I mentioned last week. And the trial showed that it worked, but what we didn't see was, had they done a separate vitamin D trial and a separate omega-3 fatty acid trial and then divided the omega-3 fatty acids into those that are fish-based and those that are vegan. So I've seen all the different ways that they use, and most importantly in clinical practice, I've seen that there's virtually no difference between the omega-3s coming from flaxseed oil and those coming from fish. But that's a separate issue. Here's what the Council on Responsible Nutrition had to say, and this was to the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, the New England Journal of Medicine published an article about the uniqueness and the quality of the omega-3s impacting on heart disease, and that's good. But they did it for one reason only. They wanted to patent the combination of these nutrients based upon a clinical study, so that if the FDA, now think of the logic of this, the FDA says you can no longer use a vitamin in a therapeutic way, but if it's a drug, you can. Same identical nutrient. They've done this for resveratrol, for example. Well, that's really what they did here. Quote, while early news coverage has focused on top-line results, the Council on Responsible Nutrition is encouraged by several very positive findings showing benefits of the omega-3 and vitamin D supplementation in additional analysis. almost a 30% reduction in heart attacks in the fish oil group compared to placebo. A 40% reduction of heart attacks in fish groups who had less than 1.5 servings of fish per week, with even more dramatic impacts among African Americans. Reduction in the rate of cancer deaths two or more years later in people who took vitamin D. The study reaffirms the safety of both vitamin D and omega-3 fatty acids and does not change decades of research showing how critical vitamin D and omega-3 supplementation are for overall health. Vitamin D, a nutrient of public health concern, plays an important role in bone health, immune function, and maintaining cardiovascular health in adults. Omega-3 is essential to cardiovascular health, prenatal health, and cognitive health. These findings are promising, and Council on Responsible Nutrition looks forward to studies that are expected to be published from this impressive data collection of over 25,000 participants. So it still comes down to this, whether it's patented or what you would just get in nature, whether you ate an orange or drank a glass of orange juice and got vitamin C, or if you took the same amount of vitamin C in a tablet, it still works. That's the bottom line. My hope is that we continue to use it in its natural form because we're also benefiting from fibers and other nutrients that are not in the patented form. Separately, the Cochrane database published a review that the omega-3 fatty acids reduce the risk of premature birth. This is a new study that's found that increasing the intake of omega-3 fatty acids, which are long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids, during pregnancy, I'm suggesting 1,500 milligrams, reduces the risk of premature birth. And by the way, this is not of little consequence. Premature birth is the leading cause of death for children under 5 years of age worldwide. And it's almost a million deaths a year. So premature babies are at a higher risk of a range of long-term conditions, visual impairment, developmental delay, and learning difficulties. So get your omega-3 fatty acids. I'm suggesting 1,500 milligrams a week. If anyone's ever been to any of our social events, going clear back, in fact, someone sent me a photograph, and they said, evidently, they didn't give me their name, but they said, here's my family in a photograph with you at one of your first cover dish dinners on Long Island. And there was a group, and I was standing, and we got a picture. And I remember that because the restaurant where we were supposed to have it called in a panic and spoke with my producer and said, we have a big problem. We have more people showing up and wanting to come than we have seats. I thought there'd be 40, 50 people. Nope, it was a little more than that. And so they didn't know what to do. So we got a hold of the people at the mall where this is and asked, could we use outdoor parking space? And they agreed. 1,500 people came. 1,500. We had to get a company that brought out tables and chairs, stuff I did not count upon. But it was a wonderful group of people, and it gave us an idea how many people would be attending, and that's about how many attended each of our cover dish dinners. Sometimes we do one a month, and we do different seatings, like a early 5 o'clock seating, a 7 o'clock seating, and later 9 o'clock seating. And I almost never eat at any of these things because I'm focused on going around and seeing how everyone is. It's like when I was on the Queen Mary, they asked me, but I go on and talk about health for 2 weeks on a trip down to Venezuela and back. And I did. A wonderful group of people. And the captain was so nice. When they were running short on organic food, they stopped off in Fort Lauderdale, and I had arranged with my office for them to pick up a lot of produce through a distributor there. So we had organic produce and great vegan meals, and the people were just as nice as they could be. About 2,500 people. And I'm supposed to go to tables at every meal. That's a trip because you spend your whole time just talking with people and going to meals. But it was worth it. It was a great sharing. But when I did have a chance, I'd go into the kitchen and I would ask the chef, could you make me up some potatoes, just a stir-fried potatoes, but with a whole bowl of garlic? And they say, a bowl of garlic? I said, not a bulb, a bowl. B-O-W-L. Okay. They'd come back and here'd be this bowl, this plate, and the plate would have some potatoes on it, probably a bowl, and then a bowl of this, and I'd put olive oil on it and then some seasonings. And that's what I'd eat. I'm a big advocate of garlic. I believe garlic is one of our 10 most perfect foods, and we should have it on a regular basis. And some people do, but not enough. This is the latest. This is from King's Howard University, and it's about garlic. Quote, garlic may be better at removing parasites than drugs. Now, we know that garlic has been used for thousands of years to not only spice up dishes, but also to help treat a variety of conditions. And it also has been used against parasitic infection. And this is in the British Medical Journal, Complementary Alternative Medicine. So they investigated this, and they found that it's the allicin, A-L-L-I-C-I-N, that's the very powerful anti-inflammatory and anti-parasitic, especially for schistosomiasis, which is endemic in the Middle East in the waters. People who are drinking water from the Nile and other contaminated rivers, schisto, S-C-H-I-S-T-O, somiasis, S-O-M-I-A-S-I-S, schistosomiasis. And liver fibrotic markers can show that you have parasitic infection. Well, there are a lot of wormwood will help, and black walnut hulls help, and elecampane root. But garlic is at the top of the list. So if you believe that you have had parasites, try drinking garlic juice, because the allicin is able to impact in an anti-inflammatory way the parasites. But I would go a little stronger. I would take a garlic juice, about 2 ounces, that's a lot, and you can get liquid garlic. And then I would add ginger juice to it and cayenne, dilute it in apple juice and drink that down twice a day. Makes a big difference. But there's a separate University of Copenhagen study that says that garlic is the master medicine. In fact, it was able to destroy resistant bacteria. Now, everyone knows how much better garlic tastes when it's in a dish. But also, some people don't like the taste and the aftertaste of garlic on their breath. You could get rid of that easily. Chlorophyll does that. Some people say, oh, eat parsley. Well, parsley is rich in chlorophyll, but you can just swish around some chlorophyll in your mouth and then take some mint. You won't taste or smell garlic at all. Anyhow, now we know from a new study that it kills resistant bacteria and fights chronic infections. So closely related to the vegetables with pronounced flavors like onions, chives, shallots, and leeks, garlic has been used in cuisines and in medicines. It's rich in magnesium and selenium and zinc, but it also, according to the University of Copenhagen, who carried out a study that showed the compounds in garlic can destroy the important components of bacteria's communication system involving regulatory RNA molecules. And this can have the effect of helping antibiotics work again in difficult cases where it once failed to make an impact. So in addition to stopping DNA molecules in the bacteria, the garlic compound can also destroy the protective slimy matrix that surrounds the bacteria, known as biofilm. And once the biofilm has been weakened or destroyed, the body's own immune system and antibiotics can attack the bacteria more directly and get rid of the infection with much easier. And the researchers say that they believe their garlic treatment could help treat patients whose outlook is otherwise poor. So I think that's very important. And this was published in Nature Scientific Reports. And by the way, they took on Staphylococcus aureus and Pseudomonas, two very difficult types of bacteria that generally must be fought using different methods. But garlic knocked them both out. And antibiotics are one of nature's wonders and a miracle drug in that respect. We can thank Alexander Fleming for that. But they're overused. And as a result, our body develops a resistance, the bacteria develops a resistance. So people die by the tens of thousands in the United States each year. And I wished hospitals would begin to use in all their cleaning equipment and all of their dressings, wounds, colloidal silver, and then Manuka honey. You'd see a lot more people recovering and a lot less problems happening if they did that. And from the National Institute of Homeopathy from India, they did a study showing that you can use homeopathy to treat successfully celiac disease. And celiac disease is, well, technically it's considered to be untreatable. And if you know anyone, or maybe you've had celiac, you suffer from an autoimmune disease, and you can't have gluten, which triggers the symptoms. So they used, and it's mainly in the small intestine that develops. And if you're predisposed even more in gluten, its trigger is a common protein found in many staple foods like barley, wheat, rye. And you can end up with gastrointestinal problems, a lack of important nutrients like iron and folate, skin rashes, muscles, musculoskeletal issues, poor growth, neurological disorders. That's all part of it. So they found that the homeopathics were able to alleviate celiac, something no drug's been able to do, and that's important. So one more reason to keep an open mind and look for the truth. And there's a lot of people trying to look for homeopathic solutions, and these people have found it. And finally, from the University of Burjand in Iran, Pilates exercise is found to improve motor control in middle-aged women. So this is important, since a lot of middle-aged women beginning to go through menopause don't exercise as much. They frequently have fatigue, and this is one of the reasons that when you don't exercise, your muscles begin to be saturated with fat and your mitochondria don't function the way they should. So Pilates can improve motor control and therefore better able to exercise. So don't give up on exercise. It's important. Oh, and by the way, you hear me talk about all the time how to take curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, and other neuroprotective nutrients like fistin, F-I-S-E-T-I-N. And the doses you take them, and frequently it's the dose that determines whether or not you are getting the benefits. Sometimes people who don't have experience in nutrition science and nutritional biochemistry and physiology, they'll give way too low a dose and say, well, we tried that, it didn't work. It may not be because it didn't work from an intrinsic point of view. It may not have worked because you didn't give it the potency. So the Salk Institute, according to Trends in Pharmacological Sciences, has come up with a new patented drug that's just made up of two nutrients. Curcumin, yep, and fistine. The very two that are not a drug if you take them separately, and of course you can bet how much this is going to cost. This is what they're doing. They're labeling theirs CMS 121 and CAD 31 and 1147. These are synthesized. Why not just eat strawberries and get your fistine and other fruits and vegetables? Why not just take your curcumin, even if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, by having curry dishes with turmeric, which is the origin of curcumin? But it's all about the money. It's all about the patents. I'm Gary Null. We are 24 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Everyone. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to go to our guest to talk about a very important topic, and that is fake news. Dr. Tim Coles from the United Kingdom, in about 10 minutes. I have a little clip to play about the real reason we were in Syria. But before then, I just want to mention that this Sunday at noon, I'll be doing at least a two-hour webinar, but I have four guests. Each one's capable of being on for an hour. And so at a certain point, even good information becomes too much if it goes too long. So I'm going to be taking your questions also and addressing them. Best places to live. The actual timeline when things are going to change so radically we won't be able to change, we won't be able to keep ahead of them, what to do before disaster strikes, what do we need in a very practical way, what do we need in an emotional way, what do we need in a spiritual way. All this will be discussed. It'll be the most definitive discussion you've ever heard anywhere. The people going to join me, Matthew Stein. He is a design engineer. And he has degrees in mechanical engineering from MIT, National Merit Scholar. We're going to talk about what you can do to help lessen or prevent fires, floods, and other natural disasters from wiping you out. That'll be one of those nuts and bolts discussion, very information heavy. Then I have from Norway, Oslo, the eminent Professor Per Espen Stoknes. He is quite simply one of the brightest people on the planet. And he founded a whole area of environmental economics and green growth and organizational psychology. And he's a heavy. And he'll be on. Professor David Orr will be on. He's an environmental journalist, social critic, professor of history, and we'll be talking also about if we know that we should be moving and getting out of harm's way, why aren't we? Gil Slade, an environmentalist, I'm going to be talking about what do we do when the government helps us? What do we do when it doesn't? Who helps us? How do we get started? What environmental groups are out there? What sustainable groups? So you talk about some heavyweights. We've got them, four people. So how long it's going to be live, and then the non-live part you can go and listen to on the archives at the same time, because not everybody can listen for 4 hours. So if you want to join me for what will be the most definitive discussion of the environment and what we can do to protect ourselves, worst best places, great details, go to prn.fm. That's prn.fm, and we've gotten as much bandwidth as we can, but all of my webinars are always packed, so get in now so you can join us, and you can download it and get a lot of information. I mean, it's going to be packed, and I'm looking 3 years out, so it's not just for today, it's for the near future. Now, we're going to go to a segment about newly leaked documents reveal the goals in Syria.
Internal documents reveal that between 2011 and 2016, the U.S. opposed the burgeoning democratic movement in Syria in favor of radical Islamist groups. Look, I'm not saying it's good news either if the U.S. is claiming to bring democracy to your country, because the U.S. has its own special brand. The seven-year Syrian civil war looks like it's coming to an end as Assad's forces are retaking the Idlib province. But several months earlier, the U.S. had already given up on the overthrow of Assad in Syria. That must have been a sad U.N. Security Council meeting for Ambassador Nikki Haley.
We welcome the opportunity to discuss the prospects for a diplomatic solution in Syria.
The U.S. foreign policy establishment didn't think democracy would replace Assad. Military intelligence documents said the opposition in Syria does not yet have the numbers, organization, or capabilities overall to overwhelm the regime force. The more probable threat the regime will be facing will come from within in the form of an attempt by high-ranking military and business elite of the regime to mount a coup against Assad. Intelligence was hoping for a mini coup, you know, nothing too fancy. According to the WikiLeaks documents, if President Bashar al-Assad was overthrown, he would not be replaced by an opposition-led Syrian democracy, but rather the same Alawite-Baathist ruling structure would continue. The U.S. was hoping instead for regime preservation. The State Department must be so confused.
If I'm not working for regime change, then who am I?
I wonder if they have muffins after this.
While the regime was left intact, the rebel groups, who we now know the U.S. thought would fail at regime change, could be mobilized to counter Iranian encroachment. The priority for U.S. intelligence officials was finding a way to counterbalance Shia Iran with Sunni power by urging Turkey to recruit Islamist remnants of the Muslim Brotherhood. According to experts on the ground, the U.S. greatly exaggerated Iran's presence in Syria and support for Assad. Indeed, the entire American policy was just to counter Iran. U.S. officials fear Iran so much that we sent troops into Syria just to wait around to see if Iran made a move, even if the military claims that we're there to fight ISIS. But ISIS is so weak in strength and morale now that an ISIS member canceled his trip to join forces in Syria because there was, quote, no toilet paper. Can't we be consistent about anything? Indeed, we're so afraid of Iran, we decided Al-Qaeda affiliates are now our friends. Also, militias armed by the Pentagon fought those armed by the CIA. How on earth are we hiring these guys? Some may argue that the U.S. never really cared about democratization, but in the Syrian case, it was much more cynical. The U.S. used a democratic movement as a tool to sideline expanding Iranian influence, while funding more extremist elements and deliberately destroying the democratic effort. Maybe we'll just see the end of U.S. supporting democracy rhetoric, which anyways is just so 2003. Even Donald Rumsfeld told the Times of London that the idea that we could fashion a democracy in Iraq seemed to me unrealistic. Well, hindsight is 2020. Or hindsight is we'll still be in Iraq in 2020. No wonder then, as the Syrian army amassed its forces in preparation for the Idlib offensive, the U.S. abandoned its old allies they were never really that committed to.
Keep in mind that if we knew the full truth of why we invaded Libya, why we destroyed Syria and fomented a civil war, why we supported a coup in Ukraine and Honduras, why we supported virtually all the dictators and potentates in the Middle East against their own citizens in the spring uprising, it would give us a different perspective of who our leaders really are. But in America, it's rather unique. As long as you're liked, as long as you look presidential, as long as you smile, wave like Ronald Reagan, have a good sense of humor, seem like you're the kind of guy like George Bush that people want to have a beer with, then your actual actions and the consequences seem irrelevant. That's on us, not them. We're going to the United Kingdom now, where my guest, Dr. Tim Coles, British journalist and writing about politics and human rights, is standing by. His articles have been published in journals and online, Newsweek, The New Statesman, Truthout, Counterpunch, and other sources. and he frequently has co-written essays with Australian investigative journalist John Pilger, and he is a doctor from Plymouth University in the United Kingdom and is currently doing postdoctoral research at the University's Cognition Institute on issues related to cognitive aspects of blindness and visual impairment. He is also the director of the Plymouth Institute for Peace Research. He's written several books, including Britain's Secret Wars, The Great Brexit Swindle, and most recently, Real Fake News, Techniques of Propaganda and Deception-Based Mind Control from Ancient Babylon to Internet Algorithms, in which he applies his expertise in the cognitive sciences to advance critical thinking to understand the tools and methods of propaganda and what is critical for separating the wheat from the chaff in real and fake news. Nice to have you with us today, Tim.
Hello, how are you?
Good. It's only been during the past several years that the idea of fake news has entered our common everyday lexicon. However, as you have documented, the concept of fake news, not simply to promote lies for lies' sake, but for a very specific purpose, to deceive individuals and groups or entire nations for a certain goal, has occurred in history going back to the ancient world. And as you noted, even Plato recommended the strategic use of lying. But whether it be ancient Greece or Rome or China or the medieval Catholic Church, and to the present, promulgating fake news has been a technique used by elites to advance control. So regardless of whether it's sophisticated or not, it's basically simulating lies and fabricated stories or news in order to control, even brainwash others. I've questioned others about the same principle, but I'm interested in what you have as far as summarizing for us the history that shows there is nothing new about fake news, and during the course of history, have you identified specific elements and goals that are common with how it has been used, particularly the relationship between fake news and the elite or a ruling class? The forum is yours.
So fake news, as far as the written record is concerned, and we have to stick with the written record because that's what we can prove, it dates back, depending on how you define it, at least to the time of ancient Babylon, where the rulers would say that we are descended from gods, so therefore we have a divine right to rule. That's probably the origins of the divine right of kings and sometimes queens. And information is key to social control. There are other forms as well, the law, outright violence, whether it's modern-day policing. So these forms of control, information being one of the pillars, is key to terrifying the public into submission. And so the fake news agenda of the time posited that somehow the ruling elites had a divine right. And also this continued into the different empires that came along. So the ancient Egyptians, for example, would claim that captured Libyan slaves were really thrilled to be converted and to become Egyptians, when in fact the historical evidence would suggest otherwise. And then going on into ancient Greece, you mentioned Plato with the idea of the noble lie, that we have to lie to the public for their own good and for the good of we, the elites, whoever we are at any time in history. And as I say, this is contingent on other pillars of social control. These days, depending on who you are, it's less easy in so-called democracies to use outright violence, although that still happens, of course, with police brutality and so on. And so it's increasingly important that propaganda, and not just outright lying, but propaganda by omission and planting the seeds of doubt in people's minds is used to set the framework of debate, so that you're not even supposed to think outside of whatever mental structures are imposed on you. And it doesn't matter whether the ruling class is relatively liberal or regressive and right-wing. It's the same agenda that we, the elite, who have the power, we deserve to be here, and therefore it's essential that the public have a certain image of us, even if that image is not true.
From your understanding of cognitive psychology and neuroscience, could you please explain the emotional and mental mechanisms that make people so susceptible to believing in political falsehoods?
It's part of human nature that's really not well understood, and there's a guy called Robert Trivers who looks into self-deception, so I would point you to his research. And it's something about the human mind that wants to believe certain things, even if it's opposing, even if our beliefs oppose the truth. When the facts are so obvious that they can no longer be denied, you get what's famously called cognitive dissonance, and that in itself can be a tool of control that I mentioned earlier, planting the seeds of doubt. So if your belief in something, it could be that Donald Trump is the savior, let's say, if the facts don't correlate to that, such as jobs, although apparently the employment is going up, jobs are actually less secure in terms of workers' rights and flatlining pay and so on. So if your belief that Trump is the savior doesn't correlate with the facts, that can create a kind of cognitive dissonance. And also with using that as a weapon against others. So when the so-called liberal Hillary Clinton, for example, accuses WikiLeaks of being Russian WikiLeaks, as she called it, with no facts or evidence, people can be self-deceived into that. If the liberal elite consensus is that Russia is the enemy, then her claim is going to conform to that, even though she presents no evidence in support of it correlates to what people want to believe. And in terms of the modern ways in which these are presented or analyzed, that's famously now called the echo chamber effect, where online or in radio, for example, you listen to the radio shows that conform to your beliefs or interests about the world. It's something that's still not understood about why human beings do that, but we just don't want to hear information that doesn't conform to our picture of the world. And I think it's important, in order, even if you don't agree with what you're listening to, it's important to listen to or read as much as you can from as many different sources, if only to understand why other people are listening to it. Try and listen at least to the Alex Jones show, not because I think it's a good quality information, it's just got more and more crazy, but I try and understand why people are actually listening to this. What do they get out of it? And from what I can tell, I learned that Alex Jones's listeners tend to be relatively privileged, but not super privileged. They don't tend to be the mega wealthy. But they, from what I can tell, they tend to be somewhat wealthier than the average American. It's mostly people in the U.S. that listen to it, although it does have a global audience. And if you look at that in terms of what's happened to the economy over the last 40 years, they're the people who have been the most precarious in some ways. I mean, the people on the bottom, the really poor people have always been poor and always been crushed. And so although they've seen a decline in their standards, it's been most noticeable among the middle class or the upper middle class. And so there's a lot of rage, you could call it white middle class rage. And people like Alex Jones are able to tap into that and exploit it. So it's not as if I agree with what he's saying or that he presents facts or evidence in most of the cases, but I listen to it because I want to try and understand why other people are listening to it. And the same could be said for more progressive radio. People on the right wing or the alt-right could listen to that and try to understand why are people who are political opponents of ours, why are they interested in progressive things? So I think if you can stand back a bit and look more objectively at different sources of information, you could learn a lot about both sides. But unfortunately, this characteristic of human beings, where it's difficult for us to do that for whatever reason, that in itself becomes a polarizing and exploitative tool that people in power can use to create left-right divisions. The dialectic, it was called in, the Platonic philosophy, if you want to go back to that.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. When you consider the media outlets that represent the intelligentsia, the professional class, the technocrats, the more educated, it's the New York Times. And indeed, in many of its columns, it's objective and fair-minded. But it's also completely biased in other areas. And one of its biggest biases is, I just read today, on Julian Assange. Now, we know that Julian Assange has released more information that has exposed more crimes against corporate and government interests than any other journalist that I'm aware of. He also has been remarkably accurate, meaning that the documents he's released agree or disagree with who they're going after, they have not been found to be inaccurate. And now for the last 6 or 7 years, he's been in effect in solitary, not really allowed any movement outside of the Ecuadorian embassy. And now that Ecuador wants to have better relationship with the United States under its new president, it's only a matter of weeks, I believe. Certainly within the next 3 months, Julian Assange will end up coming out of there. He'll be arrested by the British in all likelihood and be immediately sent to the United States. And here is where the rub comes. Already, from today's editorials in the New York Times, they're positioning him as somehow less credible, less worthy. And they did not take the side of many of the whistleblowers in the past. And when I was reading what they were writing about him, well, he really favors Russia. Well, first of all, that's not true. But that's going back to what you said. When the left gets in mind they don't like Trump, fine. You know, I don't like Trump. You know, but then vote against him in the next election and show all the reasons between now and then why what you're doing is better than what he would do. But that wasn't good enough. They already had implemented plans to, in effect, disengorge him from having a presidency before he even took his oath of office, and the Russian lie, you know, that there was meddling. And there's been no proof of that at all that I've seen. And now when Julian Assange was accused, and Hillary Clinton does not like Julian Assange. In fact, none of the Democrats and John Kerry and all of them said that, you know, he deserved to be tried for all of his crimes, yet they would not define what those crimes were. And then the irony of it is, why doesn't the New York Times run a headline, since when is it a crime to expose crimes? Why is it that the crimes you're exposing get no attention and no one will be prosecuted, but you, for exposing crimes by real criminals, you get prosecuted? And that's been the case with all these whistleblowers, and yet it was Barack Obama who did more to attack whistleblowers and then spied on the press and spied on members of Congress, and nothing happened to him. And his National Security Agency head, Clapper, lied before Congress. Nothing happened to him because everyone wanted to believe the propaganda that in the fake news that it was Russia behind everything, and it was Russia that had to be, you know, who meddled in our elections and affected the outcome. So now I'm seeing the New York Times position itself. Mark my words, the New York Times will not be sympathetic to Julian Assange. They'll be right there judging him and not being accurate in their judgments. And Assange said 3 times that I'm aware of, maybe more publicly, that my leaks of John Podesta's emails and Hillary Clinton were not from Russia. I never met with anyone in Russia. Russia didn't get these. And I have no reason to doubt what he said, yet you would not know that from what the New York Times and others are positioning themselves. Your thoughts on this, please.
That really exemplifies the limits of what's called liberal corporate media. And it's not just with Assange, although he's a particularly hated figure. I mean, the call it the liberal media, the New York Times and so on, they appeared to be fairly supportive of Hillary Clinton's campaign as compared with Trump. and Assange, they even hated Assange even more after his leaks about the emails, which appeared to be quite well-timed to damage Clinton. So they went into even more overdrive to attack Assange, having used WikiLeaks, by the way. WikiLeaks really did the New York Times and the Guardian in the UK some favors by giving them some stories when WikiLeaks first became popular. And then the media have essentially betrayed Assange and WikiLeaks. And this really reflects the limits of corporate liberal media, which you would have to expect. It raises a bigger question about why the media are so limited in the extent that they're willing to go. So, I mean, in the UK, we've got Jeremy Corbyn, who's the most progressive, by now mainstream, political candidate. And the both corporate and state media attacks on him have been absolutely extraordinary, because he represents the interests of ordinary working people. He's not an elitist figure. He doesn't come from that background, and he's not being given a ton of money by corporate interests. And so the media have spun enormous amounts of fake news to try and discredit him, which really means marginalizing the very people that could potentially benefit from his policies. And in the US, I guess the closest analogy politically would be Bernie Sanders. Now, from what I've seen of Sanders' record, he's a hawk on foreign policy. He's made quite threatening remarks about North Korea, and he supported the bombing of Serbia in 1999. But at least on social issues, Sanders is fairly in line with what most people in the US seem to want in terms of healthcare and less savage attacks on Social Security and so on. And so the mainstream just kind of steamrolled Sanders and threw their support to Clinton, which was a reflection of the Democratic Party mechanisms. So why is this so? And why on issue after issue, whether it's supporting the destruction of Libya back in 2011 or demonizing Russia when there's just no evidence for collusion and so on? And I think it cannot be pinned to one factor. There are many reasons for this. There's the fact that these are corporations, and so they're tied up with banks and other corporations, which themselves tend to donate campaign money to the Democratic Party. That's one reason. There's also the cultural issues of subordination, so that the media are fairly culturally liberal in the sense that they support gay rights or women's rights, etc., which they should be doing. But when it comes to nationalism, this nationalist idea, they don't want to go any further and say, well, you know, maybe our foreign policy is egregious. Maybe we shouldn't be threatening other countries. We have no right to do that. There's also the hierarchical structure which is imposed on media. So ordinary journalists could be extremely brave and really interested in finding truth, but they might get stopped at the editorial level, where the editors, who are paid high salaries and have a particular interest in being close to the centers of power, don't want their stories to be too progressive. And there are many factors like that which prevent the media from going, you know, any further to a more progressive anti-war stance, for example. And it's also a matter of democratizing the media. There's an organization called Fair, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. One of their articles, I think it's called Don't Be Radical, Be Liberal, or something like that, which is a critique of the limits of liberal media.
Final quick answer, if you could. When I look at the lies to legitimize America's wars, including NATO's destruction, which was really America's destruction of Gaddafi in Libya, because the aftermath of our regime change has been so catastrophic, and Libya at one time was the oasis in Africa with one of the most highest standard of living and educational basis on the continent, Now it's a devastated nation of tribalism and even an active slave trade. And the Obama administration held this as a great achievement. And no one on the left has held Hillary Clinton Obama responsible for this genocide.
Yeah, that's actually been one of the more unfortunate achievements of the right wing, where a lot of Trump supporters have actually done what the left wing should have done and said that we don't want any more of these aggressive foreign wars. We should mind our own business when it comes to attacking other countries. Now, obviously, Trump has not been true to those pledges, except on the issue of North Korea and some rhetorical moves towards peace with Russia, for which he should have been praised, by the way, and he's been attacked for that. But what happened in Libya was just an atrocity, and that's the real example of fake news. You ran a story earlier about how the U.S. Started to work with elements in Syria that were radical jihadis opposed to democracy. It was exactly the same in Libya. The same pattern was repeated, the hijacking of the Arab Spring to overthrow a regime that the US, Britain, and France had long wanted to get rid of because Gaddafi wasn't following orders by liberalizing the economy to US and European energy companies. And so the media just created the most ludicrous stories about Gaddafi was going to impose an ethnic cleansing on the people and so on, when one of the cruelest ironies was that a real ethnic cleansing of black Libyans occurred by the very jihadis that the British and the US were supporting.
Well, this is a story that needs even more in-depth coverage, and it hasn't received it. I want to thank you very much for your good work, Tim, and thank you for coming on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Tim Coles, C-O-L-E-S, from the United Kingdom. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Come bring me your softness, comfort me through all this madness. Woman, don't you know with you I'm born again.